Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. President Donald Trump was just a shout from the U.S.-Mexico border yesterday, touring prototypes of his wall, sentinels in the Southern California sun. And there were shouts. Anti-Trump protesters gathered right on the border.
No hate, no fear. Immigrants are welcome here. No hate.
Well, there is no love lost between the state's Democratic leaders and the president. The Golden State made itself a so-called sanctuary state. Trump, on his visit, pushed back.
California's sanctuary policies put the entire nation at risk. They're the best friend of the criminal. That's what exactly is happening. The criminals take refuge in these sanctuary cities. And it's very dangerous for our police and enforcement folks. The smugglers, the traffickers, the gang members, they're all taking refuge.
But California itself has gone through something of an immigration transformation, a major one. The world's sixth largest economy once passed, decades ago, one of the most restrictive immigration laws in the country. But now it's on the pro-immigration vanguard. This hour On Point, California and the fight over immigration. You can join us on air or online. What do you think of President Trump's border wall plans and about California's immigration policies? Does the Golden State give us a hint about where America can or should go moving forward or not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from San Diego is Richard Morosi, reporter for the Los Angeles Times covering the U.S.-Mexico border. Rich, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. So first of all, where were you exactly yesterday when the president came to visit those wall prototypes?
I was in Mexico. In a Mexican slum known as Rancho Escondido, which was just a few yards away from where the president was touring the prototype site.
Just a few yards away on the other side of the border. Okay, so there were protesters there. What were they saying?
There were hundreds of protesters, most of them people who had been deported from the United States, including U.S. military veterans. And they've been living down in Tijuana for years. They're very active, and they protest a lot, and the president was down, so they raised their voices and were yelling and saying, you know, they don't need a wall. And U.S. military veterans were saying, hey, Mr. President, they wanted him to write an order allowing them to come back in the country. They say they served their country. They deserve to be back in the United States.
Mm. And I mean, since it was just a few yards away, I mean, it is the border, nevertheless. Is there any possibility that they were heard at all?
Not likely.
Yeah.
You know, it's about, I'd say, about football field length. To where the president was, but they were loud. You might have heard them, right? But between them, there was very tight security. There were U.S. snipers. There was military. There was Mexican federal police. They were making a lot of noise, as they always do, but it was largely peaceful.
Yeah. You know, I want to talk with you for a few minutes, Richard, about what the border represents. Both, you know, it represents something sort of mentally and politically, of course. It's a symbol, but it's also a physical place. So for people who have never crossed the border between the United States and Mexico there in Southern California, first of all, just describe to us, what does it look like?
Yeah, much, you know, these days in this polarized debate, everything focuses on symbols of, you know, and in focusing on the walls. But tactically speaking, the walls there here in Tijuana and San Diego border have been here for decades. These people have lived with these fences for decades, and it's the most heavily fortified spot really on the border. It's in a really used as a model for smart border enforcement, and even the folks in Mexico appreciate, many of them do, having some fencing there, because it was complete chaos, out of control crime, and it did put a damper on that. Of course, it created other problems because the migration traffic went into more remote areas. But in the urban areas, like San Diego, Tijuana border, El Paso, Juarez, the fences have served to control and manage really what were chaotic situations.
So tell me more about that, because, I mean, as you said, that portion of the border is pointed to as an example of successful border security without the need for a 30-foot, you know, multi-billion-dollar wall. So what did they do down there on the California-Mexico border that seems to work so well?
Yeah, they started in the 90s. There used to be just a three-string fence there that was just literally trampled over. They used scrap metal from former helicopter landing mats from the Vietnam War era, like big sheets of steel, and ran it at 14 miles from the ocean up to about Otay Mesa, where the mountain is. It's about 14 miles. And that really didn't work too well. It stopped the cars from coming over, but people could easily scale the thing. And then later they erected double fencing, another fence behind it about 30 yards. Behind the primary fence, they built a secondary fence, taller, steel tubes, much tougher to get through. And then in between is what's known as an enforcement zone with roads, remote surveillance towers, cameras, lighting. So what it did create was a pretty well-fortified, double-fenced enforcement zone that has largely worked to keep people out.
I see.
San Diego sector now, which runs about 60 miles, I believe, you know, the average day you're going to get about 75 or 100 apprehensions of folks. And most of those are out farther east of Tijuana.
Okay. So I want to play a little bit of the president yesterday when he was reviewing the border wall prototypes. And, you know, obviously for a long time, for a couple of years now, he's believed that the United States needs something more, a giant wall between the U.S. and Mexico. And he reiterated his support for that.
The border wall is truly our first line of defense. And it's probably, if you think about it, our first and last, other than the great ICE agents and other people moving people out. It'll save thousands and thousands of lives, save taxpayers hundreds of billions of dollars by reducing crime, drug flow, welfare fraud, and burdens on schools and hospitals. The wall will save hundreds of billions of dollars, many, many times what it's going to cost.
Rich Morosi, a couple of quick questions coming off that comment by the president there. First of all, even though they're testing the prototypes down there in Southern California to see if they're impervious to attempts to scale and damage the wall, I guess, as far as I understand, there won't be that much of this particular border wall in California. Is that right?
No. And again, you know, this debate, so much about of the rhetoric is wrapped around the symbolism of a wall. And when you talk to Border Patrol agents, they're talking, you know, it's a lot more than the wall. It's border security, but it's oversimplification to say it's just the wall, right? He's trying to make a point. But anybody who's studied border security, even the longtime Border Patrol officers who've been there, say it's a combination of things that are going to work. And in California, ironically, he comes here to look at the prototypes, but they're not. That wall would not be erected in California. California already has lots of fencing. And California is largely well-managed, controlled in most areas, the cross-border traffic, right? The problems still remain, and most of those problems are down in South Texas in the Rio Grande Valley.
Which is where the wall would go if it
goes
up.
That's where the wall would go. According to the most recent budget, that's where the wall would be erected.
So at the end of that tape, we heard the president say that the wall would save hundreds of billions of dollars, many, many times what it's going to cost. But that got me thinking, I mean, look, there's one point of entry on the California-Mexico border. I think it's the busiest international land border crossing in the world, 20,000 pedestrians a day, 50,000 cars, 6,000 trucks, something like that. So, I mean, how economically intertwined is the United States or are the United States and Mexico on the border region?
Yeah, I mean, this is the mayor of San Diego wrote a letter to the president saying, hey, we've got a thriving cross-border economy here. You know, it's a multi-billion dollar economy, back and forth, everyday jobs, factory jobs in Tijuana, a lot of executives living here in San Diego. And, you know, it's a booming sector here, and it's very important, and much of it is dependent on the good management of the ports of entry. There are two here in San Diego. One of them is one of the busiest in the country. And the wall is not going to do anything, like, for instance, to combat drugs. Everybody recognizes that's a problem, right? And most of the drugs coming into the United States come in through the ports of entry. So the walls aren't going to address that issue. Unfortunately, it's a debate wrapped around symbols, and it really doesn't address the complexity of it.
Mm. Well, and so then take us to this bigger picture then of how Californians look on the idea of a border wall. I mean, the state's leaders, Democratic leaders, have been vocally opposed to it. Does that reflect sort of, I mean, it's the largest, most populous state in the country. Is there a roughly unified opinion there on this?
Well, the wall is not really an issue here. I mean, it's more of the issue with the sanctuary cities, right?
Yeah.
The population's already here. We've got about 3 million. They're here, and it's a question of how these folks are going to be handled, right? The border has been largely tamed for years down here. It's not that much of an issue. Even you talk to folks out in eastern San Diego that used to be, you know, always complaining about cross-border traffic coming over their properties. You don't hear that as much. So that's not as much of an issue. The issue is interior enforcement here in California. And speaking of symbols, I spent a lot of time in that neighborhood in Tijuana, where these prototypes are, and a lot of the people have been watching over the weeks as tactical teams test each one out. And they noticed something curious. They've got their own symbol that they prefer looking at, and that's there's big high-tension electrical transmission wires that go right over the site connecting power plants in Tijuana and San Diego. So they look up at those tension wires and they say, hey, that's a more potent symbol. You know, one guy said, hey, you can build a wall to the heavens, but we're still going to be connected because these power plants supply, light and heat for millions of people in both countries. So we're together no matter what. And also there's a natural gas pipeline that went right under that goes right under the site too. So those are also very loaded symbols.
Yeah. Well, Richard Morosi is reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He covers the U.S.-Mexico border. Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Magda.
So we're talking about President Trump's visit to California yesterday to tour prototypes of his border wall, but also the bigger picture question of what California's stance on immigration and its own journey as a state and its attitudes on immigration tell us about America's immigration story writ large. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about California's own story on immigration and what the state's view of immigration and its evolving view on immigration tells us about America's story writ large. Of course, this is in part because President Donald Trump visited California yesterday to see those prototypes of his border wall. It was his first visit to the Golden State since taking office. And since California has just recently this year declared itself a sanctuary state, the president took a moment to strongly criticize California's Democratic governor, Jerry Brown.
Well, I think Governor Brown's done a very poor job running California. They have the highest taxes in the United States. The place is totally out of control. You have sanctuary cities where you have criminals living in the sanctuary cities.
And of course, the Justice Department, through Attorney General Jeff Sessions not that long ago, announced that it would be suing the state of California for its sanctuary state laws. And in a press conference last week, California Governor Jerry Brown responded to that lawsuit.
This is basically going to war against the state of California, the engine of the American economy. It's not wise, it's not right, and it will not stand.
So why is it that Jerry Brown would say California is the engine of the American economy? Well, the state in and of itself is the sixth largest economy in the world. It's got a gross domestic product of $2.45 trillion. So my question is, how much does California depend on immigration for being that economic engine? So let's turn now to Alicia Caldwell. Excuse me, Alicia. She's an immigration reporter for The Wall Street Journal and joins us from San Diego. Alicia, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm seeing here, there's some remarkable numbers about California. And let's just start with a basic one regarding immigration. That 27%, roughly 27% of 39 million Californians are foreign born. So, I mean, how much would you say California depends on immigration for being the kind of state that it is today?
Well, it's obviously significant. I mean, just looking at the numbers, as you point out, 27-odd% are foreign born. And it's part of the community. You can't go many places in Southern California in particular and not find immigrants of all stripes from all countries. It's grown up that way. I grew up spending summers in Southern California as a kid from Arizona, and that was one of the first things we noticed was there were lots of different kinds of people from lots of different places, and that's just become a fabric of the community from top to bottom of the state.
Yeah, so I'm looking at an analysis from the Sacramento Bee, and the Sac Bee says that California depends on its immigrant workforce more than any other state in the nation, that nearly 40% of the state's full-time year-round workers are immigrants, the highest rate in America, and they've got some fascinating numbers here, like 93% of full-time sewing machine operators are immigrants, 85% of frontline agriculture workers, 85% of housekeepers, 81% of dishwashers, 60% of computer hardware engineers, software developers, most electrical engineers, medical scientists, dentists, the list goes on. Of course, they can't really differentiate based on census data of those who are undocumented and those who are not. But how long has it been this way in California? Because I'm thinking back to the mid-90s when 60% of voters there passed Proposition 187 to crack down on immigration.
Right. So it's something that's happened, you know, over the course of time. You can look back to the early 1980s, like late 1970s, when there were a number of refugee communities that built up from Southeast Asia in Southern California. And it's evolved over that course of time. You've always had a significant Hispanic presence. You know, as you probably heard some protesters shouting in San Diego yesterday and on Monday, the border, they didn't cross the border crossed them. Mm-hmm. This is a community that's been diverse for generations.
Yeah. So tell me more about that, because, again, I'm thinking that it's been diverse for generations. But at the same time, I mean, again, thinking of Prop 187, I mean, that was a ballot initiative that passed trying to deny public benefits to undocumented immigrants and even expel some undocumented children from public schools, et cetera. That was blocked by a federal court. But it seems as if sort of political attitudes around immigration were different 25 years ago.
Right. So remember, it's the mid-1990s. The economics are slightly different. You had a population of about 1.8 or so estimated illegal immigrants living in the state at the time, and 300 or so thousand children in school. And there was a concern that that was taxing on the economy. That did pass, as you said, by about 60%, and was very quickly challenged and very quickly blocked by the federal court, in part, you know, almost immediately after it was passed, and then in total by 1997. And so you can look at it as sort of California was Arizona before Arizona was, if that makes sense, on immigration.
It does.
It took a hard line. The state was sued. Things went back and turned a corner. In this case, it completely flipped on its head. And now you have 20 years later, the state saying, not only are we welcoming, but we're going to provide these sanctuary opportunities these sanctuary policies that don't say, hey, anyone who wants to come to California, just do whatever you need to do and get here. But it does say, once you're here, here are the rules that the state will operate under. Here are the rules that local and state law enforcement will operate under. They're not going to act as immigration agents, in their words, and they're not going to cooperate under general circumstances. There are some circumstances that are specifically laid out where law enforcement will cooperate for the most serious of offenders coming out of state prison and so on. So there's some degree of variation there. There's some wiggle room, if you will, to cooperation. But the state has made it clear immigrants are welcome regardless of their immigration status. There's obviously federal laws that pertain to benefits and so on that prohibit, you know, non-U.S. citizens, non-U.S. legal residents from accessing almost all social welfare benefits. School is a different situation. There's a Supreme Court ruling that holds that any child in the United States has a right to a free public education. Mm. So that's something that can't be dealt with on the state level per se, as was determined in that 1997 case. And then again later in the Arizona case in the mid-aughts, that the state can't overrun federal law. Federal law trumps on immigration.
Yeah. So I mean, it's interesting. That is exactly the reasoning, the legal reasoning that the Justice Department is using for suing California now.
Right.
We're talking about California's own immigration story and what that tells us about America and how it views or may soon view in the future the debate over immigration. And I'm speaking with Alicia Caldwell. She's immigration reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Let's get a quick call from Matt, who's calling from Clarksville, Tennessee. You're on the air, Matt.
Hello, Magna.
Hi there. What's your thought?
My thought is, as U.S. citizens, if we immigrate illegally to any other country in the world, we will be held accountable and deported. Why is it that we should not, you know, we should let, you know, illegal immigrants come over unchecked? You know, if you might get here, fine. If you get caught, we'll send you back. I have no problem with kids. Don't get me wrong. You know, the DACA kids, it was not their fault they come across the border. We got to fix that. But anybody who comes across illegally, you know, you get caught, you're going to get deported. You know, if you're a criminal and you get picked up by the law, you know, ifs, ands, or buts, you know, put you back across the border.
Mm.
You know, it's no sense in spending an over amount of money trying to hunt down everybody in the United States. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. Matt, thank you so much for your call. I actually have a person who I want to turn your question to directly. He's Kevin DeLeon, California Democratic State Senator for California's 24th District, which encompasses downtown and East Los Angeles. He actually wrote one of the sanctuary state bills that passed in California this fall. And Kevin DeLeon joins us today from Berkeley, California. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. So respond to Matt's question there. I mean, he sees, like, if you are undocumented and in the United States, you've committed a civil crime and shouldn't be here.
Well, I think Matt from Tennessee makes a salient point. I think across the spectrum, whether you're on the left or on the right or points in between, I think that we can all agree that we have a dysfunctional system in Washington. I think that we have a broken immigration system. It shouldn't take someone who has been in this country 10, 15, 20 years to normalize their legal status. So clearly, we have a broken system in Washington, D.C. that needs to be fixed. So the question is, what do you do with the sizable undocumented population, estimated to be about 11 million nationwide, that has contributed greatly to our country? I can say here in California, they have helped build up the sixth largest economy in the world. And I want to put this in context, so it's very important. There's only five large economies in the world, and that of California. It's the United States of America as a whole. It's China, Japan, Germany, and depending on the fluctuations of the sterling, the pound, it's the United Kingdom. And number six, it is California. So California's economy is larger than that of Vladimir Putin's Russia. And immigrants from all over the world, whether you're from Nigeria or Ghana, whether you're from Mexico, United Kingdom, or China or elsewhere, have contributed greatly. And what sets California apart from perhaps many other states, specifically red states, is that we value the contributions of diversity and inclusivity, regardless of your legal status. If you work hard, sweat equity, if you play by the rules, if you obey our laws, if you pledge your allegiance to red, white, and blue, hey, we believe you should become a full-fledged American. And it's because the Congress and
But if I may just jump in, Mr. DeLeon, I mean, I think a lot of people in more Republican-leaning states listening to you right now would say, well, actually, those are exactly our same values here. But the following the law part is what they're looking at and saying undocumented immigrants are not following the law. Like, even if one in 10 workers in California is undocumented, those are people who are living in the shadows and not following the law. So therefore, we have to do something about that.
Well, that's a really black and white sort of perspective, because you just mentioned a few moments ago, it is not a criminal offense, but rather a civil offense. And actually, the vast majority, not the vast majority, but a good 40% of folks don't cross the border. They actually come through ports of entry, whether it's JFK, whether it's O'Hare Airport, whether it's Logan, Dulles, or LAX or SFO or elsewhere. So we have a lot of folks coming from other parts of the world, too, that may be European, who overstay their visa. The question is, what do we deal with? How do we deal with this situation? And currently we have an administration, we have a president, and we have a attorney general that is fixated on attacking a great state like California, its economy, as well as its people. And obviously the visit by the president didn't help matters in California, and obviously I was insulted that Jeff Sessions came to my home state and announced in my home state that he was suing California because of the bill that I wrote, stating that the federal policies trump the state of California. We're not making our own immigration policies, but we do have to fix what's happening in Washington, D.C. But in the meantime, what we're going to do as elected officials in California is do everything within our power to protect the values that we adhere to, as well as our people.
Well, let me just play a little bit of tape here from the Attorney General, from Jeff Sessions, because as you mentioned, last week at a California Peace Officers Association event in Sacramento, the Attorney General did announce that the Justice Department is going to sue California to block the state's sanctuary state policies.
California absolutely, it appears to me, is using every power it has, powers it doesn't have, to frustrate federal law enforcement. So you can be sure I'm going to use every power I have to stop that.
That's Attorney General Jeff Sessions just last week. Kevin De Leon, I mean, he's making a legal point here. And in fact, a little earlier with Alicia Caldwell, we were talking about how Prop 187 all those years ago was blocked by a federal court because of the ruling that only the federal government can make immigration law. I mean, isn't that what's happening here as well?
No, because we're not making federal immigration policy in California. There's one thing that I do understand clearly is that the federal government has exclusive jurisdiction to enforce federal immigration laws, which are statutory in nature. The Congress creates those laws, and the federal government executes those laws. I understand that. So when I wrote Senate Bill 54, the California Values Act, I worked very closely with the 82nd Attorney General of the United States, former AG Eric Holder, and we believe strongly that the law that I wrote is constitutional. Now, what we're saying is that we're not interfering with immigration policy. What we're saying in California is we won't lift a single finger or spend a single cent to separate mothers from their children and children from their fathers. That if federal immigration authorities want to detain and deport, obviously that is their role and they can do so. But don't count on the state of California and don't count on local police officers to work in collaboration with you to separate innocent families. Now, if we're talking about criminal violent felons, we say we'll cooperate with you. We don't care who you are and where you come from. If you commit violent felonies in California or elsewhere, you should be gone.
Alicia Caldwell, haven't forgotten about you, so come back in here, immigration reporter for The Wall Street Journal. I mean, what do you make of what you've heard State Senator De Leon say so far?
What the senator said is what we've heard for many, many months, that the state is not interested in being an immigration arm. The state is not interested in helping coordinate immigration enforcement with the federal government, but they're not stopping the federal government. Obviously, the folks at Immigration and Customs Enforcement, at the Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of Justice now disagree. They feel as though the state is, in fact, impeding their actions and blocking them from arresting and potentially deporting people in the country illegally. That's a very fine line of who's in the right here. What's evident, though, is immigration enforcement is still happening in the state of California. I rode along with ICE agents and officers a couple of weeks ago. They were just up in Northern California making arrests. So some efforts are successful. Some efforts are not. The federal government would tell you that their efforts are being stymied by the state because the state is releasing people, criminals, in their view, from jails. Obviously, the state feels differently. And as Mr. De Leon just explained, they're not lifting a finger to help. And I don't see that changing short of a direct court directive to do that.
Yeah. Kevin De Leon, we've just got you for another minute here. I wonder, I mean, we're talking about how much California depends on immigration, how much it really defines and fuels the engine of California's economic growth. But I'm wondering if it cuts both ways. I mean, right? I mean, like all those farm laborers in the Central Valley or the garment workers in Los Angeles who are undocumented and being underpaid, like how much does California rely on these folks remaining undocumented?
Well, I think the nation relies greatly on immigrant labor, no question. I think that we have to normalize their legal status. I think that's the duty, the job, responsibility of the Congress and the executive branch, the president, to get this done, or you're going to have this vexing problem. And that's what you mentioned earlier. You have different states throughout the country are dealing with this situation in very different ways, whether it's Arizona, whether it's Alabama, or a state like California. And that's why the Congress, sooner or later, we're going to have to get their acts together and deal with this vexing issue. If not, we're going to have this continuous battle between state governments and the federal government in this case. And the last thing I'd say...
We just got about 15 seconds here.
If this was about MS-13 gang members, then they haven't captured them. They're taking mothers and fathers. They're taking dreamers away. And again, we're not going to stand for it in California.
Kevin De Leon is a California Democratic Senator for the 24th District there, which encompasses downtown and East L.A. And I should also say that he is challenging Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein in the Democratic primary for her Senate seat. Kevin De Leon, thank you so very much
for joining us.
Thank
you so much, Megna.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about California's immigration story and what the rest of the nation can learn from it. I'm the kind of person who likes to use numbers to give shapes to things. So here's a couple of numbers about California. There are approximately 1 in 10 of California's workers are undocumented. The state controller says those undocumented immigrants contribute $180 billion annually to California's GDP, and that's roughly equal to the 2015 gross domestic product for the state of Oklahoma. Now, specifically agriculture, California, an enormous agriculture state, $45 billion a year in revenue, more than half the produce consumed in the United States. A study out of the University of Southern California says that undocumented immigrants account for almost 40% of the agriculture industry in that state. We're joined today by Alicia Caldwell from San Diego. She's the immigration reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And Alicia, I'm going to come back to you in a second, but tons of people are calling in wanting to share their thoughts. So let me just get a few of them in here. Richard's calling from Two Rivers, Wisconsin. You're on the air, Richard.
My point that I want to make is I know it's not California, and I know the wall is symbolic and it's not actually a deterrent, because I spent a lot of time in McAllen, Mission area on the border, and I spent a lot of time over on South Padre Island, where you're allowed to drive your vehicle, camp overnight, fish on the Gulf. And now more than once I've seen boats come in at night and with illegal aliens or drugs, and they bury it and then they come back with a GPS day or two later when there's less, they could be less conspicuous. So there's so many other ways to get around what the wall is.
Right.
The wall is, it's just, and I'll take my comment off the air.
Richard, thank you so much for your thoughts there. Let's turn to Owen, who's calling from Wauwega, Wisconsin. You're on the air, Owen. Hi, Owen, you're with us?
Yes, hi.
Hi, Owen, go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to try to say this really quick. I wrote it down on paper, so bear with me here. All right, I believe we are dismantling the democratic system. Here in Wisconsin, we have illegal immigrants that work on the dairy farms. They estimate 60% are illegal. These immigrants stay here year-round to milk cows. It's a 365-day a year job, all right? They participate in the communities. They go to church. They pay taxes. They pay Social Security in. They buy vehicles. They buy food. They're full-time here in this country. Unfortunately, they're not allowed to vote. And as non-voting, the USDA recognizes there's 1% of the population participating in agriculture. That's legal people. We are not representing the agricultural community properly because these undocumented people have no legitimate or right to vote in this country.
Oh, and
this is a dismantle of the democratic system, and we fought wars to try to represent ourselves, you know, from taxation without representation.
Owen, I'm going to take it back from you. I really appreciate your passion there and the fact that you took the time to write that all down. But I want to turn your point and your question to another guest that we've got waiting in the wings here, Lanny Chen, joining us today from Palo Alto, California. Lanny's a fellow at the Hoover Institution and Director of Domestic Policy Studies at Stanford University. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Magna.
Thanks for standing by there. I mean, respond to what Owen was saying. He sees it as being undemocratic to not allow undocumented immigrants, and especially in the agriculture field as he represents or he's familiar with, to not let them have a voice.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very challenging perspective. I think for a lot of folks who look at this, what they say is when people entered the country illegally, they essentially may have forfeited whatever right they had to participate in democratic processes. That's certainly one point of view, and I think that's the point of view that, frankly, a lot of Republicans, particularly in Congress, and certainly the Trump administration would take. But more broadly, I do think it's important to face the fact, as you did with the numbers you presented at the start of this segment, that undocumented immigrants do account for a significant part of certain economies, and particularly here in California, where I am, they do play a very important role. So the question is how you square that with an immigration system that would allow them to contribute, but also recognize that there has to be some sort of penalty, or there has to be some sort of price paid for having entered the country as undocumented immigrants. Balancing all of these concerns and all of these issues really is at the heart of the immigration debate now.
Yeah. So, Alicia Caldwell, you've been so patient. Thank you so much. Let me reflect on what Lanny Chen is talking about, because I wonder, you know, how much do various different industries in California, what do they say about how to strike that balance?
Well, there's a big push from tech in particular, Silicon Valley, to find a path forward for both dreamers, the young immigrants who were brought here as children who don't otherwise have an immigration status, and then to fix the immigration system as a whole. You have a lot of people who wait years and years to convert from their work visa to a green card and get on that path, the so-called, you know, the idea of get in line and get yourself right. Well, that line is years, if not decades long for some people. So you have a lot of folks in industry, in high tech, in agriculture in particular, pushing the federal government to make paths for these folks in particular. And again, you have a significant number of DACA kids, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. The largest percentage, I believe, of DACA recipients are actually in California. These are kids who, by and large, are either in school or who have finished their degrees and are working now under a little bit of cloud of uncertainty about what's going to happen in the next several months, if not years. But the push is from these big corporations and, again, the big industry groups to make some sort of path, some sort of change that will allow these folks to convert and sort of normalize, if you will, whether it be on a path to citizenship eventually or a path that simply gets them permanency. So that debate is ongoing, and we'll see where it goes. Congress obviously has seemed interested, and then they don't seem interested, and then they do again. And it's been this back and forth. But there's significantly there is a significant push to get something done. Time ultimately will tell as you run up to the midterm elections. Of course, you run out of time.
Yeah.
At least in this very short period of this year. So it's a little bit of an unknown, but there's a lot of pressure on a lot of different people from a lot of different corners to get something done, because, as you said, you do have the significant population in California. You do have a significant impact on the economy here.
Right. So Lanny Chen, respond to that, because I wonder with, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier this hour about the sanctuary state laws that California has passed. It seems as if California and other jurisdictions around the country are basically saying, for better or for worse, like, we're going to take the actions that we can on the state level for as long as there's this endless stalemate at the federal level. I mean, but how, what's the long-term effectiveness of that, if any?
Well, the challenge, Meghna, is that we've entered a period now where policy has become highly unstable. We're not only seeing this in immigration, we're seeing it across issue areas. The problem really is Congress has abdicated its responsibility to act on this issue. It is Congress's responsibility, fundamentally, to pass statutory changes to immigration law that would address the question of people who were brought here as undocumented immigrants as children, the broader question about what kind of immigration system we want to have as a country, this debate, for example, about whether we ought to have a system that preferences family ties, so-called chain migration that the president says, versus a more merit-based system. I mean, these are all questions that Congress needs to address. And so in the absence of congressional action, what we first saw was President Obama acting via executive action, mm-hmm. which is perhaps the most unstable way to make policy. And then you also have states like California stepping into the void. Now, the problem with that is you end up with a patchwork of enforcement and laws, different states doing different things. So you cross the border from California to Arizona, you have a very different regime in place there. So the challenge with states acting is not so much that that they can't be effective in the short run. They probably can in effectuating whatever the goals of the citizens of that state are. The problem is, in the long run, this is no way to make policy. And so Congress does need to act. Unfortunately, they have not evinced any ability to do so in any coherent way for a very long time.
But of course, I mean, key members of Congress would point to the president as right now being the reason why they couldn't even get a DACA agreement, right? Because he was presented with multiple bipartisan bills with bipartisan support and seemed to move the goalposts every single time.
Well, the president bears responsibility, obviously, for expressing a point of view about what policy he believes in and ultimately sticking to that. But, you know, that to me is a little bit of a cop-out. Members of Congress have an opportunity to work together, and there appears to actually be a sufficient number of Republicans and Democrats willing to do so, particularly on the DACA issue specifically. They could make the decision tomorrow to get together and solve that issue specifically. The question has always been, does this get wrapped up in a broader discussion about immigration reform, you know, the so-called comprehensive package that includes all of these other things? While I would love that personally, I'd love to see a comprehensive immigration solution. One thing is absolutely clear, they could deal with elements of this one at a time if they wanted to. But frankly, I think the challenge is none of them really wants to touch it in a midterm election year. And that's really the unspoken truth for a lot of these members of Congress. They don't want to take tough action during a year when they know they're going to be up for re-election. That fundamentally is the dynamic at play.
Well, let me get at least another call or two here before I run out too much time. Jim is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. You're on the air, Jim.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for taking me.
You're most welcome. What's your, what do you want to say?
Okay, first, I would like to point out one obvious fact. The first illegal immigrants to the U.S. actually came into Virginia and Plymouth Rock.
Yeah.
Number two, I'm an ex-Marine, and I served with a lot of different races and individuals. And we need to learn how to do that in our society, not just in our military. Number three, we need an intelligent integration of policy with facts based on intelligent conversation and not fear.
Yeah.
And that's what I see going on, is it's fear-based.
Jim, thank you so much for your call. Alicia Caldwell, you know, we heard Jim's perspective there about this being a fear, or a lot of immigration discussion being fear-based right now. But I think also just people do have different points of view of what the outcomes or the realities of what immigration has brought to California specifically. They're just different points of view. I'm looking here at a comment that we got on our website. Someone calling themselves Honesty says that California's progressive Democrat politicians have transformed a vibrant, beautiful state, once admired by almost everyone, into a third world country with Hollywood, a high-tech sector, and a beautiful coastal area. Honesty goes on to say businesses in the middle class are fleeing as the quality of life has declined due to high home prices, high state taxes, and progressive policies that have attracted legions of homeless and unbridled illegal immigration. What do you make of that?
Well, so full disclosure, I'm new to California. I've only been here about 6 months, but some of those things make a little bit of sense, right? There is a growing homeless population. There is a very high cost of living. It's really difficult to buy houses. There's a housing crisis in the state of California and so on. I don't know the third world country that he or that Honesty has described. Again, I'm new, but that doesn't seem to ring true to what I have known in my brief travels of living in the state of California. But what you do have is a pretty complex state with a multitude of economic issues from top to bottom that don't just have to do with immigration, as far as I can tell. I'm not entirely certain how one connects the cost of housing, particularly in Southern California or the Bay Area, to immigration,
yeah.
or in this case, illegal immigration. It's possible that I'm missing some connection there. But there are issues within the state. There are issues in every state. I just moved from Washington, D.C. There are issues in the District of Columbia that are not connected to immigration. I think sometimes things get a little bit strung together in a way that sounds reasonable until you dig a little bit in, and then some of those connections aren't quite what we think they are. There are a lot of, again, complexities, to repeat that word, about what's happening in the state of California. Some may be related to immigration. Some certainly are not. Again, I would point to the housing prices. $800,000 for a small home. Not really sure the connection there.
Well, Lan Hee Chen, did you have a thought on that?
Well, I think it is. Immigration is an issue through which people evaluate the level of anxiety they have about the economy, if that makes sense. I think people tend to use the issue of immigration as an excuse in a lot of situations if they're feeling anxious about the economic conditions. And there's no question in California, as Alicia notes, there are a number of issues here that are deeply problematic. We do have a housing problem. We have an issue with a growing social safety net that seems to continue to crowd out spending on other important state priorities year after year. So there are a number of issues here in California that we've got to deal with. So I think people in their minds connect it, maybe not so much empirically, but they connect it really as part of a meme, which is they feel that to the extent that there is economic turmoil or economic turbulence that's caused by any number of different issues, immigration is one of those causes. And while there certainly may be tangential relationships, it's probably not as direct as some folks would assume.
Well, we've just got about a minute left here, and I wanted to circle back to something Alicia said earlier, because Alicia was talking about how, regarding some immigration laws, that California was Arizona before Arizona was Arizona, and that was when they were trying to crack down on undocumented immigrants. But looking at the bigger picture of immigration and America's sort of attitudes toward it, is California sort of a glimpse into what the rest of the nation, how the rest of the nation might look upon immigration in the future, or is that too much of a stretch? Lanny, we've just got 30 seconds to go here.
Well, I think we have to be careful to sort of conclude that California is the harbinger for the rest of the country. I mean, there are reasons why I think California is unusual, and the level of exposure that we have to immigrants and immigrant culture in California is significantly different from other parts of the country.
Yeah, so, it could be an outlier, right?
Yeah, I think, and so I think we have to be careful about assuming that it is sort of the start of the trend. But one thing is absolutely clear, which is that immigrants are becoming more a fabric of many different parts of the country. And to the extent that California can signal what that might be like for other parts of the country, I do think people should take notice of what's happening here.
Well, Lan Hee Chen, joining us today from Palo Alto, California, fellow at the Hoover Institution and director of domestic policy studies at Stanford. Thank you so very much for joining us. And I should also note that Lanny was advisor to Marco Rubio's 2016 presidential campaign. And Alicia Caldwell in San Diego, immigration reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Pleasure to speak with you as well. Thank you so very much.
You too, Magna.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. Thanks for listening. This is On Point.